We mentioned last week that we were going to, a little bit out of character for us, but we're going to revisit Shmuel Beis Perek Yud Aleph. So, the Perek tells the story of David and Bathsheba. The truth is that Perek Yud Beis is a bit necessary to fully understand what's going on, but I think we had too many questions that we had on Perek Yud Aleph that to leave it unaddressed does not seem right. So we're going to go through it again and try to see how the Mefarshim understand what took place here. So a quick summary of David and the story of David and Bathsheba, Perek Yud Aleph, and then in particular we'll focus in on the problems that we had that we were going to try to address. So the basic psukim don't make David HaMelech look too good, right? We're basically told that David HaMelech is on his roof. He sees Bathsheba bathing either through a window or on her roof. He sends for her. She sends her back home afterwards. She ends up pregnant. And then he basically gets rid of Uriah, her husband, and marries her. That's the very, very, very quick version. A few more details that we need in order to, I think, better appreciate it was, again, he called Uriah to come back. Uriah was one of his soldiers. He called for Uriah to come back from the battle and sent him home. Uriah did not go home. Uriah did not go home. He insisted on staying. David HaMelech tried to entice him with some food and drink, and still he did not go home. And after he basically refused the king's orders, that's when David sent Uriah with a little note to give to Yoav, who was the general, telling him to go to the front lines and make sure that he's gotten rid of, and that he dies in the context of war. And kachava, that is what happens. So again, the questions that we had were A, if Bathsheba is a married woman, how can it be that David was together with her? How can it be that he continued it afterwards? And for all intents and purposes, he seems to have, maybe not directly, but certainly indirectly, killed Uriah and ensured Uriah's death, which does not seem like appropriate conduct either. So how are we to understand the conduct of David HaMelech? So, there is a Gemara in Shabbos, which is important just to give some context to the discussion over here. But the Gemara in Shabbos says that Kol HaOmer David Chata Eino Ela Toa. Anybody who says that David sinned is making a mistake. Okay, but we need to understand then what happened, because what are the psukim telling us? How do we understand that whatever is going on here with David HaMelech is in fact not a sin? I will point out that there is an approach in the Mefarshim, a minority approach. Most prominently, it's an approach from the Abarbanel, who assumes that David did sin. Seems that David did sin, and he took a married woman. But, and this comes up more in the next parak, David did full tshuva. David did full tshuva for what he did. So what do you do with the Gemara? The Gemara says, Kol Omer David Chata Eino Ela Toa. He suggests that based on another line in the Gemara, that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who made the statement in the Gemara, was trying, he comes from Shevet Yehuda, he was basically trying to defend his ancestor. But you can't take his words exactly at face value. Again, the alternative might be, Kol Omer David Chata Eino Ela Toa is showing us the power of tshuva, meaning that he made a mistake, but that chait has been removed. So meaning you could maybe then understand that Kol Omer David Chata Eino Ela Toa is if to anybody who says that the chait remains, that person is making an error, because David did full tshuva. Okay. But again, that is the that seems to be an outlier type of shot. That is not what we would say is normative. And in fact, many of the later Mefarshim, in particular, attack the Abarbanel for what he says is that's not the pshat in the Gemara, and therefore it cannot be true. So we need to understand. So what is going on in the Gemara? So the key to understanding the Gemara seems to be two concepts that we have. Again, we'll call it that there's the understanding of Gemara through the halachic lens, these things halachically permitted, and then we have to try and understand it, through what we would call the hashkafic lens. In terms of the halachic lens, there are two principles that are at work here. We need one principle in order to explain question number one, which is, if she's a married woman, how is this allowed? Then we need another halachic principle to understand question number two, is how is his conduct with Uriah Hachiti going to be justified? So the key to understanding the first question seems to be a Gemara. Now the Gemara tells us a fascinating concept. The Gemara in Maseches Ksuba says that Kol HaYotze Mibeis David, anybody who went out to fight from David HaMelech's army would write a get for his wife before going to battle. Why would they do such a thing? Because we didn't know. Again, the means of communication were not as good. The chances that somebody was not going to come back were too great. And we wanted to protect the women. We didn't want to end up with what we'd call an aguna situation, where you have a soldier who has been killed. He's not identified. He's taken captive, Rahman al-Islam, whatever it may be. Something could happen. And therefore, and again, it generally wasn't the only problem with this approach is Kohanim, because if a Kohen divorces his wife, when he returns, he can't remarry her. Anybody else is able to remarry her upon her return, but the Kohanim weren't the ones going out fighting on the front lines. The Kohanim were involved in Avodah, the Beis HaMikdash. The Kohanim were the spiritual leaders. Maybe were there in supporting in other roles, but that they presumably were not the main soldiers. So the fact that anybody Yotze that would go out to war, Mibeis David Kosvin Get Liishto, would write a bill of divorce to his wife, is the beginning of the explanation. Meaning, Uriah, as in the now, becomes critical. And again, I think we mentioned last week, right, there's no mention that David knew that about where Uriah was. There's no mention that David had to figure out, you know, where is the husband. Right away, after Bathsheba tells him that she's pregnant, he says, oh, send the message to Yoav. So clearly, David knew that Uriah was a soldier. He knew that Uriah was out at war. In which case, he also knew that every soldier follows the protocol. And the protocol is that they write a bill of divorce to their wives before they go out. Now, there is a machlokas in the Gemara about what type of get they would write, and it greatly impacts this story. Some Rishonim understand that they wrote a full-fledged bill of divorce, meaning, theoretically, if, you know, the woman decided, he's been gone for a while, I'm not interested in him anymore, she could simply just walk away because she's not a married woman anymore, even if he returns. Tosos and other Rishonim however explain that the get that was given was a conditional get. It was a conditional get. That she will be divorced if he dies in battle, then their wives will be considered to be divorced from the time that they left. Or if he doesn't return by a certain amount of time, then retroactively, she is going to be divorced. Now, in this case, there's a huge difference between the two. And David HaMelech's conduct, according to the latter explanation, is very difficult to understand. Right? If every soldier wrote a full unconditional get, so then David HaMelech knows that she is not a married woman, and he takes her, he sends her back, and then when Uriah, when he calls for Uriah to come back as part of, we'll call it his cover up, that he wants to make sure that when she ends up, people know that she's pregnant, they can see that it was from Uriah. So she would, that would be a, we'll call it a remarriage, right? Taking her as a wife again. But in that interim period, she was not married to Uriah. But if you understand that it was a conditional get, so then if Uriah returns home, then that get is retroactively no longer considered to be a get, in which case she was a married woman the entire time. And if she's a married woman the entire time, then David certainly sinned by taking her. Meaning the way out of saying David didn't sin is because she was not a married woman, because she was divorced. But if the get was conditional on him not returning, then if he returns, which now he's returning because David is sending him home, then through David's own conduct of bringing Uriah back, he is ensuring that what he did is a sin. And by Uriah not returning home, he saves David HaMelech. Right? There's a certain irony that exists according to this, because by the condition is that he has to return to his wife. Since he didn't return to his wife, then the get is still open-ended. And then when he doesn't return, when he's actually killed, retroactively she is divorced. But if he would have gone back to his house, then that get is nullified. And then she's a married woman until Uriah dies later in the story. So David HaMelech, again, ironically, if you understand that approach of Tosfos, that it was a conditional get, it's very hard to understand the conduct of David HaMelech. Why would David do it? Apparently, the need for this sort of cover-up, and the in David's mind, the Chilul Hashem that would have existed had what happened became public, averting that Chilul Hashem was more important than him avoiding his personal sin. And therefore, having Uriah come back so that people will not think that this baby, again, obviously he would inform the baby at some point that in terms of your yichus and who you're allowed to marry and things like that. But covering up right now to avoid the Chilul Hashem of Bathsheba being pregnant without Uriah around is worse than causing his own sin by ensuring that she is an Eishes Ish. Which is pretty incredible. Pretty incredible. It's almost a personal sacrifice on the part of David to make sure that the matter of her being pregnant is not going to become public. Yes.
I have a question.
Only one?
Well, sorry. Where is she going to be then, the baby or the offspring of that union? Wouldn't that be a mantle?
Yeah. Absolutely. He would, the assumption is that he would have to tell, he would inform the child later, or make sure Bathsheba informs the child, and the child will know his own lineage and that he's only allowed to marry a mamzeres or whatever it is. But yeah. But again, if you understand like Tosfos, then you're a little bit forced into this conclusion that David HaMelech assumed that the Chilul Hashem would be worse. We also now understand why it was so important. David kept asking, did you go home, did you not go home? Because whether he went home or whether he didn't go home has major implications as to whether she's a married woman or whether she's not a married woman. So again, when David keeps inquiring, okay, but eat, drink, go home. Again, he was certainly pushing her to go home. But in the end, when she did not go home, then that certainly, I guess, fell in David's favor. Once, okay, so that's part one. So there are basically, again, the approach to assuming that there was no chait is because of this concept that any soldier that would go out, and it's critical that that Uriah was a soldier. There is one other outlying shot, which is that Uriah is called what? Uriah Hachiti. Hachiti. Maybe Uriah wasn't Jewish. If Uriah wasn't Jewish, then halachically, she's not right, he's a Chiti, then maybe he Bathsheba was not even a married woman halachically. But that, again, I would call that one of those outlying opinions as well. The mainstream approach in the major Mefarshim is this, that it's based on anybody that soldier that went out wrote a bill of divorce. If it was an unconditional bill of divorce, then everything's a lot smoother. If it was a conditional divorce, then David, again, in the end, it works out for David. But David was almost hurting himself in terms of his conduct. So that's question one, part A. Now, David HaMelech is faced with a problem because Uriah, in the end, didn't go back. And there's going to be, even if there was no sin, so either there'll be a sin retroactively later when he comes back, or he needs to still figure out how to cover up the Chilul Hashem. And therefore, he needs to get rid of Uriah, and he needs to figure out a plan to do that. David's not going to kill Uriah. On this, the critical line is when Uriah talks back to David HaMelech. And you don't talk back to a king. We have a halacha called Mori B'Machos. What exactly happened? Where is that pasuk? Vayomer Uriah el David. It's a pasuk Yid Aleph. He asks Uriah, how come you're not going home? Vayomer Uriah el David. Ha'arom v'Yisrael v'Yehuda yoshim asugos. The Jews are sitting in their tents. Vadoni yo v'avdei adonai b'nasdei. And your servants are in the field. Vani avol b'sila chol v'shos v'shgav mishti chayecha v'chein asir v'yim esad adar zeh. He basically swears that I will not do what the king says because it is inappropriate. Included there also is a line that you're not supposed to say in front of the king, which is Adoni Yoav. Adoni Yoav. You do not refer to somebody else, as at least another human being, as your master in front of the king. And anything which is a pagam, anything which attacks the kavod of a melech, we have Aloch of Mored B'Malchus, is considered to be a rebellion against the king, and is liable for death, and does not require a Beis Din. The king can decide it on his own. And that seems to be, and again, it may things have, quote-unquote, worked out for David, because he needed to get rid of Uriah, but Uriah gave him the solution. By Uriah being disrespectful and not following through on the orders of the king, he was a Mored B'Malchus. He went against the king, and David probably was entitled to kill him directly. But that really would have been bad, looked bad. Right? If David kills him and then takes his wife, that's not going to go over well. So again, he was allowed, he deserved being punished for disrespecting the king, but David came up with a plan that would do it in a roundabout way and avoid any possible Chilul Hashem. Okay, so that addresses, again, from the halachic standpoint, how you can justify the Gemara saying, Kol Omer David Chata, Eino El HaToah, that David, that anybody who says that David sinned is making a mistake. But the truth is, again, that from the next parak, as we'll see, Nasan HaNavi gives David a significant amount of Musar. There is tshuva for David to do. And that would seem to be that at least on a level of a David HaMelech, using these what we'll call halachic loopholes may have been inappropriate. Meaning technically, he got away with it, right? There was nothing that we can pin him on as being a chait. But that doesn't mean that there isn't tshuva which is necessary, because as great and a high level that a David HaMelech lives on, there needs to be, you need to be above board. You need to be above board. And that we do not necessarily find here. Now, there might be those who, you know, are bothered, but why is the push-up shot of the psukim so bad? And then Chazal come along and bail him out, right? Which is the way it may appear on the surface. But the truth is that it's not the case. Meaning, the fact that Chazal are the ones that end up bailing him out is just, it happens to be that way. But the stories of the, or not just the stories, the content of the Torah and the Nevi'im is meant to be understood through the lens of Torah Sheba'al Peh. Not every detail is written down. And the fact that certain things are written down and certain things are not written down does not mean that they were filling in parts in order to make things better. It simply means that the picture wasn't filled in all the way. Almost like you have an outline. So the psukim lay out the facts. But the facts don't necessarily include all the back and forth of how those things developed. We have that in outlines and stories all the time. Right? And again, once you know that the two have to work together, it's designed that Torah Shebichsav and Torah Sheba'al Peh are going to be mashlim, are going to complete one another. So then it's not a problem that this happens to be in the psukim, this happens to not be in the psukim. That was the approach that the Navi took, and that the Navi chose to leave these things out. But again, it was part of the Masorah going back to those times, that these are the details that are necessary to fully appreciate the story that took place. I think there's one last broader point, which is here. And again, I think there's a Zohar which sort of implies like this. But there are times when it's hard to know exactly how to say this. We normally view what we do through the lens of our individual decisions. But there are people and there are moments in time that are larger than any specific person. And the import and the impact of what those decisions are going to be are broader. In which case, I wouldn't say Bechira is taken away, but things are definitely moved in pushed in a certain direction. I don't think it's coincidental that the line of the lineage of the Melech HaMashiach and Malchus Beis David has a whole bunch of these kinds of stories, right? It starts with Yehuda and Tamar. We have the story of Rus and Boaz, not exactly an easy story to understand. We have David and Bathsheba, and again Shlomo HaMelech is going to emerge. How can it be that everything, I think I said this once beforehand, if Shlomo, if the Melech HaMashiach had a Shidduch resume, he might not get a Shidduch, but he could be Mashiach. If you go back, this one might be my father. It's not the way that these things usually go. And what it seems to be is that when there is a tremendous amount of Kedusha coming into the world, then the opposite forces in the world are stronger. And there is, I don't know if I would call it an equivalent amount of Tumah, but there is a Koach of Tumah. Again, the world always has to be at an equilibrium. And for any infusion of Kedusha that's in the world, there is a parallel infusion of Tumah, because it has to be that we're left with Bechira. And the only way that we have free choice is if we lived in a balanced world. Right? That's one of the other explanations for hardening of Paro's heart. That Hashem didn't harden Paro's heart. He didn't. Paro's heart was hardened because Hashem didn't help him out anymore. Right? He saw the... Why did he harden Paro's heart? In order to make it fair for Paro. Meaning, Paro was seeing all these miracles. He almost didn't have Bechira. So in order to make that equilibrium, that Paro should be able to make his own decision, he had to have not seen the Yad Hashem so clearly. Because otherwise, it's obvious that it's the Yad Hashem. And in order to give Paro the opportunity to decide what he wants to do, Hashem had to harden his heart so that it's not going to be as influenced when you see, hail balls coming down with fire in them. Then everybody knows it's from Hashem. And then Paro has no Bechira. So we usually think that the hardening of the heart is a lack of Bechira, but it could be the exact opposite, that Hashem had to harden his heart in order to equal out the level of Bechira. And it seems the same thing happens here as well, that there is the Satan, and again, there are stories about a deer that was running and David shooting an arrow, and that's how he ended up seeing Bathsheba, and it was really the Satan. There's something about these moments in history that are going to have impact on the Jewish people for forever that influence what's going on. And again, as much as David has to take responsibility, but the fact that there was the Tumah associated with it actually protects, you know, it protects the Malach HaMashiach a little bit. That not everything, if everything was perfect, then there's more of a kitrug of the Satan. But when things are tucked away in a certain certain sense, then there is the ability to rise up from it and to redeem the world through it. That seems to be what's going on. So yes, does David HaMelech in the end take responsibility? Absolutely. He takes full responsibility. We'll learn that, Mirtz Hashem, in the next parak. What is he taking responsibility for? So that is this machlokas. Whether it's that he actually sinned, which again, seems to be against that Gemara and is a really an outlier opinion. Or is it that on the level of a David, he realized that this still wasn't the way that he should have acted. But can we chalk it up technically to a sin? No. Was it necessary to go this way in terms of the way the world was going to move to its end, to a place of Mashiach? Maybe. We don't know. But it could be that's what's tucked away in this quite incredible story of David and Bathsheba. And again, it's going to be something which comes up other times. The Uriachiti is going to come up, and the Bathsheba is going to come up. It's something which you know hovers over David. But again, this, I think, helps just put it in a little bit of context.